Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. This is the rustic version of Matters of Life and Death because we're slightly strangely sitting in a garden.
Yeah, very unusually for us, facing over the table rather than over the internet. But looking forward to picking up a couple of questions from the listeners that we've been kind of building up over the last weeks and months. Thanks, as always, to everyone who sends questions in. I'll say this again at the end of the show, as always, but we love to have your questions, links to interesting news stories, research you've seen. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. And our first question comes from a listener. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing this, called Vild, maybe Vilda, who is from Norway. And Vild says this, I'm a material scientist and I'm currently looking for a new job. Currently, the Norwegian Defence Research Establishment are announcing many new jobs. I listened to your episode on Christian pacifism, and I think I agree that Christians ought to fight and protect certain values in the framework of just war. However, I'm not sure whether one can use the same argument for spending one's work life researching war-related topics, especially when one considers all the complicated issues that arise with war technologies like the ones you already covered in your episode on drones and AI. I guess the bigger question is also, how does one as a Christian choose a career path? Are there any rules, or is the only answer to individually pray and try to discern God's will?
Yeah, I suppose I can't help thinking that this is a question which Christians have wrestled with for right from the beginning of the early Christian church, because there were, I think, many Christians, people converted, who were actually in the Roman army or in the royal household, and they must have wrestled with the question of what their calling was as a Christian in that situation. But it seems the general advice that came from church leaders and apostles and so on was not to seek to change your situation in life. In principle, if God had put you in that position, then the right thing to do was to try to be a faithful Christian in the place where you'd been positioned.
Mm. And I guess you can see there's a commonality with some of the Paul's advice in the epistles, you know, to, you know, controversial advice we read today to slaves, you know, don't try and break free and escape, but instead, you know, he kind of gives equal commandments to kind of love and serve to both master and slave, and kind of almost subverting the institution from within, but not radically ripping up the social order. Christians should, you know, rise up and try and free all the slaves. And I know for a fact in early church history, there was a lot of debate about whether Christians could or should be soldiers, particularly difficult for those who convert. Obviously, after already, you know, maybe signing up to serve 10 years in the Roman legions, you can't just easily chuck that out the window. But I know we also have archaeological evidence that there are lots, if you can see from kind of Christian gravestones, that there were people who were soldiers, and, you know, that's recorded on their gravestones along with a an ichthus or a cross, something like that. So there wasn't necessarily any sense that these things are necessarily incompatible, though they have, as you say, been raising questions since the beginning of the church.
So I suppose there's a fundamental difference with, you could imagine somebody, I mean, thinking, coming to the more modern era, thinking about arms manufacture, you could imagine somebody who is in a quite a significant position within the arms industry, who then becomes a Christian.
Yeah.
They might be saying, well, look, you know, does that mean I should immediately resign? Or is it possible that I can be a witness for God in this place where he's put me? That's perhaps a bit different from sitting
actively
on the
applying,
outside and saying, you know, I'm at the beginning of my life and career, professional, should I apply for a big arms manufacturer, for instance?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a different discussion. But I think, you know, we talked about this some time ago in an episode where we touched on kind of pacifism and different Christian thoughts around war. And I think we're both broadly kind of hew closer to the just war theory that, you know, not all forms of violence are necessarily prohibited for Christians. And I think if that is the case, then, you know, if you believe in just war theory, if you believe that there can be in circumstances time when it's right for Christians to take up arms, then someone has to build those arms to take up. You know, this debate often comes up in the Church of England context because there's an annual arms expo which is hosted at C of E HQ in London.
Really?
If you can believe
that.
Yes, it's a big conference venue, and the Church of England is not using it. They hire it out for conferences and things, and one of the people is one of the UK's kind of leading land warfare arms expo 2025 or whatever it is called. And there are lots of kind of Christian pacifist groups who protest outside and say this is utterly inappropriate. And the church's line has kind of been, well, actually, we're not a pacifist church. And therefore, we believe, you know, when used appropriately, it's okay to build bullets and missiles and tanks and rifles and body armor and gas masks and radios and all the other paraphernalia that needed to fight a war, because we don't believe it would be wrong in certain circumstances for the UK to take up arms. It's just, you know, make sure those arms don't fall into the wrong hands.
And just as an aside, what is the Church of England's policy on investment? They've got a huge amount of money invested. Do they avoid arms manufacturing?
No, off the top of my head, they have an ethical investment policy, which it restricts them investing in certain companies if I think more than 5 or 10% of their business is derived from things like tobacco, pornography, and now, you know, coal and the dirtier forms of fossil fuel pollution. And I think they don't restrict investment in arms companies as long as that arms company is kind of adhering to the UK kind of government's rules and make sure your guns don't end up in the hands of some militia in the DRC or you know, get dropped onto Kyiv by Russian bombers. But otherwise, no, I don't think they oppose investing in arms in principle.
Yeah, very. I mean, these things are complex, aren't they? I mean, another difference which occurs to me is that developing weapons which are genuinely defensive in nature, where their sole purpose is to protect from aggression, does seem to be different morally from, you know,
building Kevlar bodyproof, bulletproof vests and things like that,
versus developing a sniper rifle, you know, his ability to take out someone at greater distance. And yet, I would guess and both of us here, we're perhaps guilty of slightly talking off the top of our heads. You know, if we had a military weapons specialist, I suspect they would say that the distinction is pretty spurious.
Of course, you know, to defend. You know, people often cite the example of World War II as the kind of most just of just wars. You know, very few people, apart from outright pacifists, would say it was wrong for the United Kingdom to take up arms to defend itself and ultimately to defeat the Nazis and free Europe from bondage. But you don't just do that with, you know, battlements and armor and helmets. We had to build bombs and bullets and rifles and tanks, and in the end we had to invade another country to liberate it, you know, at the great cost. And I think you're right. I think there is a slightly specious idea that there is purely defensive military endeavors, and I think, you know, to defend yourself you need to ultimately kill other human beings who are attacking you, to boil it down. And the other thing to say though here is, going back to the original question from Vild, is is he's not even talking about building missiles and bullets and tanks, but it's about working as a material scientist in the kind of defense research. And this would be, you know, order, several steps down the chain. You know, it's not building the tank, it's understanding different kinds of ballistic armor that might end up creating new kinds of steel that might wrap around next generation of tanks. You know, so it's research that doesn't solely have a defensive purpose. I'm sure that kind of new kind of steel might be, you have other kind of peaceful purposes, even if you are being paid and employed by a defense establishment.
Yeah, so I mean, I just wonder whether the framework we've previously talked about, which is the idea of cooperation with evil, might be applied in this situation. In other words, it's not a black and white, yes, this is good, no, this is wrong, but let's dissect the precise role you're playing and saying, how much is your role? Is it, how close are you to the, is it proximate or distant to the evil outcome?
Direct or indirect?
Is it direct or indirect? Yeah. Is it intentional or unintentional? You know, and I think you could say, for a material scientist working in a lab, you could argue that it's unintentional, not intentional, that it's indirect and not direct, and that it's distant and not proximate. In which case, it's not that different from many other jobs and professions that we're called to work. And I think the other thing is that the whole concept of acting as salt and light, you know, we are called as Christians to penetrate society. That only works if the Christians are all in the health service and
teachers and other kind of workers, unambiguously positive professions.
But when it comes to, you know, there's a complete desert of people outside.
Yeah.
That really doesn't work. That's not the vision of society which I think you get in the New Testament.
And the extreme example of that is the tradition of military chaplains, you know, taking ordained ministers and actually embedding them into, you know, army battalions or on a Royal Naval ship, you know, which was a huge part of, it remains a lot, significant part of the UK armed forces today. I don't know more about other countries, but there's clearly a sense that, you know, these people don't carry weapons. They're not there to kill, but they're not simply kind of, you know, trying to persuade people to put down arms. They're there to provide pastoral care and in some sense to support the war effort, right? And that's why the government pays for them, right? It's not the church paying for them. The government pays for them out of the defence budget because they think chaplaincy is a part of the kind of panoply of support that a soldier needs.
But, and I understand they're actually very popular, I mean, surprisingly, within the armed
forces. Intensely secular armed forces.
In a very secular armed forces. And a similar kind of thing happened with the role of the chaplains in the hospitals at the time of COVID.
Yes.
That in some inspired decision in the NHS, the chaplains were designated as essential emergency healthcare staff and therefore were there at the time supporting the staff and supporting the people who were dying.
Probably the only Christian ministers who could, you know, when churches were locked down and people were told to stay at home, chaplains could strap on their PPE and actually go and be with the bereaved and the dying in hospitals and also to support the healthcare staff struggling through this kind of tsunami of overwhelmed in intensive care.
So I think the force of our discussion would be that there is clearly nuance here. I mean, and I think many Christians would feel working very closely to, for instance, developing, directly developing and testing weapons that are designed to kill people. They may feel that is too close.
Potentially.
Whereas other roles within the industry, they may feel, and I think it's very much a matter of individual conscience, and as in so many areas of in society, you know, we're called to live transparent lives of integrity, but in the end, each of us is responsible for the decisions we take.
Yeah, and I think it may even be the case of, you know, you might decide it's okay to take a job as a material scientist in the defense lab, but what particular projects you work on might be a question and a subsequent question of discernment. You know, do I want to work on this thing which is creating some kind of chemical weapon delivery system? Maybe not. Do I want to work on, you know, better filters for gas masks in case Norway's attacked with a chemical weapon? Yes, absolutely. And how can I use the gifts and the skills and the experience God has blessed me with as an engineer so that I can, you know, help people to live thriving, flourishing lives. I absolutely believe you could use those in a defense environment. But it might all come down to, a job, almost project by project, job by job.
And the other thing just to say is that there's a lot of experience over the years of so-called dual-use technology.
Yes.
So it turns out that technology, which is amazingly valuable from a healthcare or other, some other very obviously positive thing, at the same time, the very same technology can be employed in a very negative and damaging way. And therefore, this sense that all truth is God's truth, and that we shouldn't ring fence whole areas where we say Christians, this is no-go areas for Christians. Mm.
And it works both ways. There are plenty of examples of technology that was originally developed by the military that has turned out to have a profoundly beneficial impact. The internet was born largely in part from DARPANET, which was funded by the Defense Agency of the United States taxpayer, because they thought it would help, win future wars and develop research faster. But it overspilled into this incredible, world-changing technology that we use right now to record this podcast. And the counterexample, I guess, would be something like dynamite, originally intended for mining purposes. And then Alfred Nobel suddenly realized what he had done, and he had unleashed this devastatingly powerful explosive, and armies were picking it up and using it for war, hence why he founded the Nobel Peace Prize in his kind of sense to try and extirpate his guilt. So you can never be confident in our complex, interconnected world what you make. You could take a secular job working in peaceful means as a material scientist and accidentally end up being indirectly involved in the death of millions, So on one level, we have to say some things are beyond our control. The world is too complex. And I don't think God wants us to be crippled with guilt about potentialities that are very difficult to understand.
Yes, but at the same time, we're called to be wise and thoughtful about how we direct our efforts and therefore and prayerful. So this is just as so often this balance between recognizing that there are many things which are beyond our pay grade. We can't predict what the implications of what we're doing are. At the same time, we're called to be wise and accountable for our choices.
And just this last little section of Veal's question is kind of zooming out from the question of war research. How does one as a Christian choose a career path? Are there rules, or is it simply just praying and kind of listening to God's voice? Do you have any thoughts on that question, briefly?
it's a classic question which students ask, isn't it? How do I know what God is guiding me to? And I think, looking back, inevitably I'm looking back now over 50 years of trying to follow Christ in my life. What I can see far more clearly than I could is God's overwhelming providence, that every choice, every action, every decision, every chance conversation, all of these things are enwrapped in a much bigger picture of God's providence. And I think of that Psalm 23 where it says, surely goodness and mercy will pursue me all the days of my life. Whatever we do, they're on our track. They won't let us get away. And therefore, I think you can relax in a way. I think people who are younger tend to agonize too much about the sense that, have I got it wrong? Am I in the wrong place? And how do I know what's right? And so on. And I think we can have a greater trust that we do what seems to be the right thing at the right time. And we trust to God's providence.
Yes, I really sympathize with that. I mean, I remember as a student, in fact, having a lot of deep thought about this and how do you make good decisions and how do you decide? And, should I be, just waiting and not choosing what job to take or what university to apply to until I've heard from the Lord clearly? And you end up getting a bit paralyzed, a bit stuck in your head. And I think at the heart of it is this idea that, life is a maze and God has preordained one path through the maze. At every turn, there's going to be a fork in the road, and I have to make sure I pick the one that God has already decided I have to go. And that is a recipe for kind of crippling guilt, anxiety. And I just think it doesn't really tally up with how God and the Holy Spirit works in the Bible, does it? That actually God and his providence and his mysterious grace gives us lots of that agency and latitude. And in many ways, there are sometimes multiple good choices you could make. And I don't think God wants to strong arm us into one or the other one if they're both. So, you know, sometimes clearly there's a job you absolutely shouldn't do and there's just a job you should do, but more often there'll be two or three jobs on the line and they might each have good things and bad things. And it's a question of discernment and wisdom. And God says, well, I've given you the scriptures, the spirit, wise Christians, prayer, and then make a decision.
Yeah, and I've just been reflecting on this recently, that the most clear example of this is in the life of Jesus, because, you know, Jesus is, as Christians believe, this is God in human form. This is the one through whom the entire cosmos is sustained. Mm. And yet, here he is making decisions, saying, you know, why don't we do this? Let's cross the lake, you know, give these people something to eat, you know, asking questions, you know. Mm. He isn't living as like someone who has a hotline, who has...
No. A little voice in his ear telling him, turn right, turn left.
Yes, yeah. That's right. In fact, he's improvising every moment. Mm. And clearly events are happening to him, and, you know, by chance someone touches him and he says, who touched me? And
or, you know, when the Jews try and throw him off the cliff and he says, it's not my time, and just slips through the crowd, you know, and there's a fork in the road, and because he wasn't going to die there. I don't know. There is a sense in which certainly he's not, as you say, some kind of robot that is following a pre-programmed sense. And yet there is a meta-narrative.
There is a meta-narrative.
Where all the Gospels are structured around a journey that ends at the cross.
Yes.
And that encircling Israel, but getting closer to Jerusalem, and that peak that was always going to happen on Holy Week.
So if he is our model, if we want to say, what does it mean to be live a godly life? And the answer is, well, let's live like Jesus. Then he is giving us this sense of moment by moment improvisation whilst saying, I do always those things which please the Father.
Yeah, regularly retreating to the mountaintops to talk to the Father, to listen to the Spirit, and yet also, as you say, not paralyzed or difficult to make decisions. I mean, I remember reading a book about this, which we don't have time to go into the detail. It talked about there's like theologically there's different ideas about God's will, and there's kind of the universal salvific will, you know, that cannot be thwarted. The nations will bow down and worship. Jesus will return. And then there's kind of lower things, you know. But the title of the book, I always remember, was called Just Do Something. And the kind of thrust of the author was, you know, don't get lost in your own head. Like, just make good decisions, pray about them, and then just do something, which I think is stayed with me.
This month only, Premier Insight is giving you an exclusive pre-release teaser to John Lennox's brand new book, God, AI and the End of Humanity, only available to the Premier Insight audience. In this powerful resource, Professor Lennox, a renowned Oxford professor and leading Christian thinker, explores the rise of artificial intelligence, biblical prophecy and the spiritual challenges ahead, grounded in scripture, not speculation. It's a must-read in our culture, and it's our thank you for your gift to Premier Insight, helping believers like you stand firm in truth, even in an age of digital confusion. You can give now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to receive your special teaser. Thank you. This month only, Premier Insight is giving you an exclusive pre-release teaser to John Lennox's brand new book, God, AI and the End of Humanity, only available to the Premier Insight audience. In this powerful resource, Professor Lennox, a renowned Oxford professor and leading Christian thinker, explores the rise of artificial intelligence, biblical prophecy and the spiritual challenges ahead, grounded in scripture, not speculation. It's a must-read in our culture, and it's our thank you for your gift to Premier Insight, helping believers like you stand firm in truth, even in an age of digital confusion. You can give now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to receive your special teaser. Thank you.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Shall we move on to our second question?
Yeah, this is a sort of handbrake turn.
Yeah,
into
slightly handbrake turn. This is a question from Hannah, who emailed in sharing a link to a BBC article, which is headlined, We always joked Dad looked nothing like his parents. Then we found out why. And it's Hannah says this. There seems to be a number of articles popping up showing babies were swapped at birth many moons ago, something NHS swore had never happened. This must be devastating for the families and children involved and seems to highlight some of the nature-nurture traits that people might have. What is a good, godly response in these situations for both the families affected from the NHS and also for churches supporting people in this situation? Shall I quickly summarize,
yeah, summarize the story?
Yeah. People haven't come across it. We'll put a link in the show notes, but it's a report in the BBC about a man who, about a guy called Matthew, which is not his real name, to protect his identity, who learnt after his father had died that his father had actually been accidentally swapped for another baby after being given birth at an NHS hospital maternity home, maternity ward in the late kind of 40s and 50s, which is the latest of a series. The BBC News has now reported on 5 separate cases of babies that were swapped by mistake in maternity wards. And this all came about because Matthew, the person here, took one of those classic saliva DNA sample tests that you can do. You send off at the post, you spit into a pot, post it back, they do a DNA analysis and give you some results, and all, but also plug it into their growing kind of database of DNA results. And which found out that his DNA very closely matched a group of another kind of family group on the website who he'd never heard of. He started exchanging messages through the website with these women who seemed to be very close relatives, even though he didn't know them. And they tracked down birth records and found that their father and his father had been born one day apart in exactly the same hospital in East London in 1946, just a few months after the end of the Second World War. And clearly what must have happened is that one of the midwives or the nurses, you can explain a bit more, but they must have accidentally swapped the babies over and returned them to their different mums. No one realised, and, you know, off they go.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a fascinating sort of just little insight into maternity practices back.
Yes, it seems absolutely baffling that this could happen to us today.
Yeah, but what had developed, and I think it all starts in the Victorian era, really, was the idea that childbirth is this terrible... So there was a real contrast between middle-class views of childbirth compared to what happened in the sort of deprived regions where, you know, there was often no medical help at all. Mm. And you would just have a birth companion or a sort of self-taught midwife. But in the middle classes, the whole theory was that childbirth causes an enormous strain on the mother's body. And the most important thing after giving birth is she must have absolute rest and frequently absolute bed rest. Mm.
And for days.
The obvious thing to do is therefore to take all the worry and concern about caring for her baby off her and leave it to the professionals. And so they had these massive nurseries. You've probably seen those pictures.
Yeah,
with sort of
classic black and white photos.
And just cots all lined up with 20, 30, 40 babies, all in rows. And then you've got these gowned and masked nurses doing their jobs, looking after the babies. And so once you imagine that, of course, it's absolutely obvious that they're going to make mistakes. Mm. I mean, they didn't go for any kind of robust means of identification.
No, they just had these little cards attached to the cot that said the name and things. But obviously, when you pick a newborn baby up, they all look the same, really, don't they, if we're honest? So if you put it down, and if two babies
two
have been
babies
taken
having
out,
their nappies changed,
and then they come back to the ward, all you have to do
which
is put
one was
in
which?
The wrong one,
yeah,
and then suddenly how do you identify them? You know, today we solve that problem with the little bracelets around the wrist. They hadn't quite tumbled into that at that point.
Yeah, so unfortunately, it's a disaster waiting to happen. And so then when you say, well, what's a godly Christian response to this? Well, of course, I mean, this is a problem created by bizarre and stupid, in retrospect, healthcare practices.
They thought they were doing the right thing.
Anyone with a sort of... You would have thought it was pretty obvious that mothers had been having babies... for a very long time.
Long before we invented
the
hospital.
Natural instinct of a mother. Every mother is immediately to cuddle her baby.
Yeah.
And to, you know, and that this is all a very important part of the process. And it turns out physiologically it's important in terms of lactation and it even releases oxytocin, which prevents the risk, reduces the risk of hemorrhage, mother's hemorrhage, and all sorts of surprise, surprise. You know,
God's plan worked out all right.
And it doesn't take a genius to work that out, and that maybe all these human practices might have unintended consequences. And
psychologically, not just physiologically. I mean, the attachment, what we know about trauma and attachment now, ripping children away from their mothers and mothers away from their children is profoundly traumatizing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure all kinds of negative things came from that. And it was all in this medical paternalism that doctors in particular, but then nurses as well, midwives, know best. And mothers have to be obedient, and even bed rest is very dangerous, we now know, to put women to after birth. There's an increased risk of blood clotting and pulmonary embolus and all that kind of stuff, and it's much safer to mobilize rapidly. So it's just a reflection of those kind of practices. But there's a deeper issue here, and that is the unforeseen consequences of doing DNA testing. And I think this is something that genetic professionals are very well aware of, that all kinds of unintended consequences can happen if you do. So giving a DNA sample is totally different from doing a blood test, getting a culture swab. It sounds as though it's the same thing, but it's fundamentally different.
Yes, because DNA, unlike any other sample from your body, is not just totally unique to you, but it connects you to a web of other human beings and their own unique DNA code in ways that are becoming increasingly easy to identify.
Absolutely. And in fact, it connects you all the way back to the history of humankind. You know, that's the extraordinary thing.
The story of Homo sapiens is almost encoded into every chromosome. Yeah.
And all your relations and everything in your history and everyone who was part of you. But of course, where it really comes to is it's my siblings, it's my parents, my biological parents. That's all there in my DNA. And of course, what turns out is that things are not so often what I expected, or the implications of what I've found has implications for other people, for all my relationships, for my family and so on.
And this is the dilemma that this guy Matthew discovers, is that he identifies, my father is dead, so he's not going to be hurt by discovering this. But if I pursue this, I pull on this thread, there's an entire another family somewhere else who have grown up having no idea that their dad was biologically not related to them and had been swapped at birth in an East London hospital in 1946. Is that knowledge, is that good knowledge to discover 80 years after the fact? Or is that sometimes there's some things that are better left stones that are better left unturned?
Well, and that's one of those unanswerable questions. But I think what the medical answer would be is that all that should be discussed in detail with you before you have the test. So this is the whole role of genetic counselors. And what would often happen is that a genetic counselor would sit down with you and just discuss about your family and why we're doing this test. And now, have you thought about the possible implications? Have you thought about what would happen if? Have you thought about what would happen if we discovered that you were at high risk of some abnormality? Would you, and that this had implications for your siblings? Have you thought about the possibilities and so on? And it would only be after this very detailed counselling that the person themselves can decide, you know what, I've decided I won't do that. Or, yes, I really want to know. I'm prepared for the outcome. I want to go ahead. And I think the view from the medical side is that in the end, provided people are fully counselled, it's your choice. You can go ahead, but you really must think beforehand what the implications might be.
And that is a really helpful framework that's developed on the medical side, but the DNA testing genie is out of the bottle. It's not controlled by the medical establishment. It's not regulated particularly effectively, as far as I'm aware. You know, there are dozens of companies that for relatively small fees, you know, people would often give these to their family members as a Christmas present for £20-30. Let's find out what percentage Irish we are, you know. Let's find out, you know, is it true, the old folk tale that we came descended from the Vikings, you know, this kind of stuff. People go into it in a very light-hearted, almost frivolous way. And I don't say this to criticize them, because why would you think you've not known anything, and then suddenly the results come back and you find out, you know, most commonly what people find out is that actually they're the product of an affair, and they have no relationship to one of their parents, which has been either known about and hushed up or never known about. And, you know, and then you have the dilemma of, I just wanted to see if I was a bit Viking, but now I'm going to have to like rake over the most painful experience that's of right. my parents' and lives,
destroy
my parents' marriage, break apart my siblings who pick sides. And it kind of unspools from there. But obviously 23andMe are not going to insist that everyone, you know, they're a profit-making company. They're not going to insist that everyone takes an hour of genetic counseling before they spit into the tube after, you know, to get their Christmas present prank. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, well, and this is the problem, that this is so-called direct-to-consumer testing. And, you know, I've noticed these days you walk on the tube in the underground in London and you see these massive adverts for all this
business.
Kind of... It's a very big business. And I think that many medical professionals feel deeply concerned about this because... And what's happening, of course, is then people are turning up with their GP, NHS GP, saying, I've paid a lot of money for this testing and it's suggested this. Now I want to have an MRI to see whether... And it's the NHS who has to pick up all the pieces, and particularly the so-called worried well, that it's very often the sort of people who respond to this testing are often young, relatively healthy, fit,
hypochondriacs,
well-educated people, whereas the real need, medical need, is often in people, you know, who are all the opposite of that, the older, less well-educated, and so on. So it's this is a real, and yet, you know, as we've often said in these podcasts, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. This is here to stay, and somehow we need to raise awareness of what DNA testing can do, of its power, but its potentially explosive negative consequences.
And in this particular case, imagine someone is listening who was in the situation that Matthew was in and found out that one of their parents, or even themselves, was biologically unrelated to their family and was a result of a tragic administrative cock-up 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago. I doubt it happens anymore, but let's, you know, it clearly wasn't just once or twice. Like, this must have happened over a number of occasions.
Oh, it has. And to be honest, it does happen, but this time it's in the lab and not in the nursery. So the nursery has been well and truly
regulated lockdown, yes.
But when it comes to these samples, all in a, you know, 20 samples in a cell sorter and in a lab being processed, unfortunately, they continue to happen even with very well regulated labs. So there's all, I'm afraid it does continue and probably will continue.
Yeah, I mean, there's been several cases of IVF, isn't there, where parents have discovered very obviously that the child they've nurtured for 9 months in their womb and then given birth to is not theirs because the race doesn't match, and that means that their embryo that they fertilized, the IVF facility has implanted it in someone else, and then you have the terrible dilemma of what do you do about that. I guess it comes down to a lot of those age-old questions about nature and nurture and what do we believe about family, and is it, you know, is sharing DNA in a bloodline more important than 9 months in the womb? And I think going back to these original cases, it feels like to me, you know, if you have spent 50, 60 years with someone believing them and them acting as your mother, they are your mother. The fact that they don't share
absolutely.
Your DNA doesn't undermine the fact that motherhood is bigger than just blood, isn't it? It's about a role and it's about a love and about nurture. And it would seem a quite reductive idea to be like, oh, it was all a lie. My real mum is out there. Well, there is someone out there who has a relationship to you, but this person who raised you is your real mum.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, I have a feeling that there is some connection between this incredibly powerful genetic tooling we now have and clairvoyance, particularly in the scriptures, where... it's interesting that whereas prophecy, whereas seeing God's overall plans for humankind is always seen as a positive thing, and God gives them through his prophets his message, this precision prediction of events or descriptions of insight into particular relationships and so on is often seen as something that's occult, as seen as something that God's people should not go for.
Not all knowledge is good knowledge.
Not all knowledge is good knowledge. And therefore, if I was offered a DNA test, for example, that could provide very precise prediction about how long I had to live and what I would die from, would I actually want it? Would that help me to live a godly life? You know, there are examples in the Bible, aren't there, of people who wanted to know the future, but it always goes wrong. It's clouded with evil. So I think it's all about the wise use of technology and sometimes saying no. I know I could find out. And you know what? I've taken a thoughtful, wise decision. I'm not going to go there.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. We talked before, haven't we, about the kind of prohibition on soothsaying and fortune telling in the scriptures. And I think the other thing I would say on this one is it speaks to me of a kind of unhealthy way in which we've kind of DNA-ified our understanding of what it means to be human.
Yeah.
You know, and that previously, obviously, humans have long known that there is some kind of heritage. We look like our parents,
the seeds,
right? Lots of metaphors. But as we've understood the precise nature of how that's passed down, it feels to me like we've as a culture have taken a bit of a cul-de-sac and got a bit laser focused, a bit tunnel vision on that. And this comes up, you know, reflecting this a lot when, you know, we talked before about how, you know, we've adopted our daughter and we hear stories in the adoption world of, you know, grandparents who refuse to acknowledge an adopted granddaughter or son as theirs because they don't share my blood, they don't share my DNA. And it just seems such a facile, reductive understanding of what it means to be a family. That, again, you don't see in scripture. You see all kinds of interesting blended families. We literally talk about each other, brothers and sisters who share no DNA, share no blood tie. I think there's something deeply unhealthy about how we have, because we've learned about DNA, it seems to dominate our understanding of what it means to be kin, what it means to be related.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think the reason for that is that it comes with a scientific aura. And therefore, we live in a culture which privileges scientific and quantitative and materialistic explanations. And I think this leads very rapidly onto a kind of genetic determinism.
Yes.
I am programmed, this has happened, and there's nothing that I can do about it. And that sort of taps into a sort of fatalistic, mechanistic understanding of humanity. And I think genetic determinism is scientific rubbish. I mean, all the evidence is that we're not determined. We genuinely are free. Although, of course, we're influenced by our genes. We're influenced by our background and so on. But it's also spiritually, it's deeply unhelpful because of this fatalism that comes with it.
Yeah. And the biblical, the godly conception of what it means to be family is not visible on a microscope. It can't be reduced to chromosomes. You know, you see that so clearly in the New Testament, that God is building a new kind of family. And I'm not saying that kinship and biological nature is irrelevant. Of course it isn't. But we have to resist the idea that I can determine who my family are, who my kin are, who I have an obligation to simply by checking people's DNA code. That's just not how God believes kind of human families and societies, let alone the church, should be structured.
Yeah, and therefore there's this kind of openness, isn't there? Rather than this deterministic, you know, fatalistic, you know, which so many of the pagan religions have this element of fatalism. You know, it's your karma, it's the stars, it's the curse that was laid on you, whatever it is. Christianity has this glorious sense of freedom that I can be redeemed from all that. Yeah. I can start anew.
God can write a new story.
And by God's grace, I can become a new creature.
And you see that's obviously a key point in which the Jesus movement expands from its origins in Judaism, which is a profoundly heritable thing. You know, I mean, I know in some traditions you can convert, but fundamentally, it's an idea that you need to be able to trace your descent back to Abraham.
The seed of Abraham.
And of course, you're in or you're out. It is. They didn't know the language of DNA, but it is a profoundly heritable thing. And yet the radical message of Jesus is that there's a new covenant and God is building a new people. And you and I can be spiritual children of Abraham despite being thoroughly Gentile.
Didn't he say you could have children of Abraham out of these stones or something?
Something like that.
Which is, you know, of course, with those absolute
outrage.
Heresy.
He's trolling them, isn't he, basically?
Yeah, he is. Yeah. He's lampooning their...
Yes.
Their
kind of narrow obsession.
Yeah, yeah.
And saying God has a bigger story to tell about what it means to become part of his family. And I think we need to model that openness, as you say, in our own families. Right. Well, thanks so much, Hannah and Vild, for those really fascinating questions. Please, as we said at the beginning, please do write in if you have your own dilemmas or interesting news links that you think we should riff on, the email address is molad@premier.org.uk. But also do have a look at our respective websites. There's lots of more interesting information there. You can find Dad's johnwyatt.com. He's got lots of talks and other podcasts, videos, writings, essays. And also you can find some of my journalism at tswyatt.com. Otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.